Welcome. Today we're talking about how exciting biplane technology offers new insight to treatment for aneurysms. You're listening to Checkup Chat with Evergreen Health, and my guest is Dr. Amoon Abdu. She's a neurosurgeon with Evergreen Health. Dr. Abdu, let's set the stage and let the listeners know what an aneurysm is. Where does it occur? How does it develop? Give us a little overview on aneurysms.
So aneurysm, typically when we're talking about brain aneurysms, we're talking about a sort of like a balloon that forms on an artery. And it typically happens with time. It's slightly more common with women. The only risk factor that we know of that's modifiable is smoking. Smoking not only makes it grow, but it also increases the risk of rupture. And then there's some familial form where people can have multiple family members with cerebral aneurysms, so they're just genetically predisposed. But that's not that common. So basically, it's a little outpouching on the side of an artery that forms due to stress in the arterial wall through time. And when it reaches a critical size, it can rupture. And if it ruptures, 10% of people don't make it to the hospital. And of the 50% that do make it, they don't do well. They're either dead or significantly disabled. And about 20% go out after the treatment, usually about several weeks, doing okay. So if the key is if we think, if we find an aneurysm, if we think it has a risk of rupture during the lifetime of that patient, we prefer treating it and not waiting till it ruptures, because the odds of you doing well are pretty low if it ruptures.
People hear aneurysm and they think of stroke. What's the difference?
Right. Stroke basically is a brain equivalent to heart attack. Stroke just means dead brain cells. You can get a stroke after an aneurysm rupture, but an aneurysm rupture is not equivalent to a stroke. Stroke just means there is either a blockage to one of the main arteries to your brain, and that part of the brain dies, or you can have a hemorrhage, either from high blood pressure or something in the brain itself, the brain cells itself, that rupture, and you can have a clot in the brain. So we call that a hemorrhagic stroke. A subarachnoid hemorrhage, basically it's a rupture of an aneurysm in the layer above your brain called the subarachnoid space. So typically you don't present with a stroke. You present with a rupture of aneurysm, so a bleeding on that space. What can happen, though, is about 10 to 20% can have a stroke few days after the rupture because the blood around the brain vessels can irritate them and the brain vessels can clamp down and you can get decreased blood flow and get a stroke that way. But subarachnoid hemorrhage doesn't necessarily mean a stroke. It's a completely different disease.
Are there any symptoms, Dr. Abdu? And if there aren't any, how is it detected? Is this something that might be detected upon a routine physical examination? How do we even know?
Very good question. So two things, right? We're talking about unruptured aneurysm versus subarachnoid hemorrhage. Subarachnoid hemorrhage, if you have a hemorrhage, you will know. It's the worst headache of your life. And even people that have migraines or headaches all the time, this is not going to be anything like it. It's like something blew up in your brain, right? It's going to be very sudden onset, worst headache of your life. If you're alive, you're going to call 911, you're going to come because you've never had anything like this and it doesn't go away with Tylenol or any medications, over-the-counter medications. Or you're just not well enough that you've collapsed that somebody's called 911. So that's very symptomatic. We're talking about the asymptomatic aneurysms. Those ones, they're completely asymptomatic. The aneurysms are very, very tiny. We're talking about 5, 6, 7 millimeters. Typically, they don't cause any symptoms. Sometimes the very rare ones do get really large, and you can have symptoms from compression of nearby structures like a nerve or something, but almost always they're asymptomatic. And we now pick them up because you can easily get an MRI or typically what we call an MRA or a CTA, looking at brain vessels. And typically that's done because you had a headache or somebody's concerned about a tumor or something like that, and they're incidentally picked up. And then you'd get referred to a doctor such as myself that specializes in this. And then we talk about whether that needs to be treated or not. Now, about 3 to 4% of Americans have aneurysms. And if you look at the population, that's about 10 million people with brain aneurysms. But the ones that rupture, it's about 30,000 per year. So it's pretty uncommon to have a rupture, right? So a lot of people have aneurysms, but that doesn't mean that they have to be treated. What it does mean, though, is that you have to see a vascular neurosurgeon. And then we can talk about, A, do you need to be treated? B, if you do need to be treated, there's multiple options for you to be treated. And we tailor it based on the patient, per se. And there's a lot of factors we look at.
Let's talk about some of those factors. How do you decide if it does need to be treated? And then when you're discussing with the patient, doctor, how what treatment looks like, tell us about some of the treatment options available and biplane technology. Tell us what that is.
Fantastic. So Mary Smith gets an MRI because she's having migraines, and then they sent her to actually look at the vessels because they saw something funny, like a potential aneurysm, and she has an aneurysm. It measures 6 millimeters, and she's been sent to me. She is only 43 years old. She's a smoker. That, for me, depending on the location, based on the size and her age, we would probably potentially talk about treatment. So certain sizes are higher risk for treatment. So anything, but that depends on the age. If in our world, nothing is clear cut. Well, most of the times you can do a study to say, well, if you come in with this size aneurysm and some other person comes with this size of aneurysm, we'll treat this patient, but we won't treat that other patient because we're going to see if that other patient, if their aneurysm will rupture at any point in their lifetime. And that would be a good study. And then you just follow those patients. The problem is the patient that initially signed up to not be treated in 3 or 4 years may say, you know what, I'm too anxious about this. Let me get treated. And so we would never truly know when the aneurysm would have ruptured in that patient. That being said, we do have a couple of studies. One was published in the early 2000s. Another one is a big study that was done in the Japanese study. And it looked like it looked at all these aneurysms that we're now picking up because we can easily get MRIs and CTAs and MRAs now, as opposed to like 30 years ago when we only knew about aneurysms because they ruptured. And the question was, what do we do with these aneurysms? And it gave us some sort of guideline as to which aneurysms should be treated and which shouldn't, but it's not the set Bible. And so you have to tailor it to a patient. So the risk of rupture to an aneurysm is accumulated with time. And on average, it's about 1%, 0.5 to 1% per year. So if you have a very young patient in their 30s, 40s, 50s, it's very different from a patient that's in their 80s, 90s, because you're trying to prevent something from happening in the future. So the longer you live, or the longer you have a chance to live, the higher the chance that you may have a rupture during those years. So that's how we discuss. So once we've discussed, we've looked at the aneurysm, we think that there is a chance that it could rupture in your lifetime, which depends on every patient, right? You could be a 43-year-old and recently got diagnosed with cancer, only have 5 years to live. Then that doesn't make any sense for me to treat an aneurysm that is relatively low risk. So once we decide it's low risk, if we decide it's extremely low risk, like a tiny aneurysm that is in a low risk location, then we may follow it with non-invasive imaging. So we may get a CTA or an MRA in a year or so. If we think that it may rupture in your lifetime, we go to the next step, which is called a diagnostic angiogram, and that's where we use the biplane suite. And the biplane suite is basically an X-ray machine. It takes X-rays in all different positions, so you get a 3D anatomy of the brain. And basically, you go in, typically we go in through the groin arteries. It's like getting a cardiac stent or a cardiac procedure. Most people are familiar with those procedures. But basically, we go in through the arteries of the groin with a catheter, go all the way up through the aorta, bypass the heart, and then put the catheter in the vessels leading to the brain vessels. And then we inject a dye to look at the brain vessels themselves and get a 3D anatomy. And that gives us two things. One, how easy is it to get up there if we do need to treat it that way? But most importantly, it gives you the best anatomy of the aneurysm per se. Once we do that and we think that we bring the patient back, and you generally have a somewhat of a sense whether you were going to treat this or not based on the initial non-invasive MRA or CTA anyways, because you've met the patient and you know the size, and you know, so there's a little bit more information that you can get from a diagnostic angiogram, like the morphology and all that stuff. And if you've decided it needs to get treated, there's multiple options. I'm a neurosurgeon by training, which was the traditional way of treating things. The only way of treating it was through brain surgery. But in 1995 in the U.S., the FDA approved endovascular treatment, which is the technique that you'd use through the biplane. And when I started training in 2004, I'd say about 90% of aneurysms were still getting brain surgery. And I finished in 2011. Depending on what part of the country you were, I'd say probably 50, if not majority, was getting treated endovascular. And now definitely most patients are getting treated endovascular because the technique has gotten better and better and better. But that's not to say that the open surgery is not good. And so we sit there and talk, and we talk about the different options. Regarding open surgery, it's a little bit more technically challenging, but it's still a very good option because the risk of the aneurysm coming back after an open surgery is extremely low, especially if you've proven afterwards with a diagnostic angiogram that it's gone, it's less than 3% chance of it coming. So it's a very attractive option for a very young patient or a patient that doesn't want to follow up. The endovascular route, there's multiple things. Initially, we came up with little coils, typically platinum-based, that would go into the aneurysm, and you plug it up from the inside through the catheters that we talked about in the biplane suite. So it's no brain surgery. This is all done through catheters that we've placed in through the groin and then park the catheter into the brain, into the aneurysm itself, and you basically fill it like you fill a Russian doll. Depending on the morphology and how it looks like, you may not be able to just do that. Sometimes you may have to put a stent in to hold the coils in. And now we also have these specialized stents that diverts blood away from the aneurysm, and the blood it goes into the artery. And with time, the blood goes into the artery to the main brain, to the main branches and vessels, and it won't go into the aneurysm, and in about a year it can clot off. So that's a fantastic option. So we give all those options, and it really depends on, a lot of times you can have either, and it depends on your preference. And I think patients should be the driver's seat. I don't think doctors should come and tell you which procedure you should take. I think the job of the doctor is to do a very good job, we need to do a very good job illustrating, even with diagrams, all the different options so that patients could understand in patient terms as to what they want. The endovascular options with the coiling, for example, there is a chance that it can come back, so you have to follow up for quite a while. You typically not with an angiogram, but we could follow with a non-invasive MRA, for example. With that flow diverter that I told you, you probably have to follow up for about a year, and once we've proven that it's gone, then you may not need follow-up. With the endovascular procedures, you may need to be on antiplatelet medications. These are blood thinners, typically two of them. So if there's any contraindication to that, or if you're not going to take your medications because you're not going to be compliant, this is probably not a good idea for you to have that procedure. It may be better to do the open surgery. So that's what I tell my patients. I tell my patients, you know, I have zero preference because I like both procedures. My goal is for you to have the outcome, the best outcome, but also the outcome that you want, right? You know, if you're going to be very apprehensive about it, brain surgery, I don't think the doctor should push through that direction because they don't feel comfortable doing, or they don't do the other procedures. So since when you're dually trained, you can offer both, especially if you feel comfortable doing both.
As we wrap up, what a fascinating bit of technology and a fascinating topic. And you're so good at explaining it. What a great educator you are. Dr. Abdou, tell us about your multidisciplinary team. What type of providers would be involved? And kind of give us your best advice about whether it's watching and waiting, lifestyle changes to reduce the risk of rupture, what you really want listeners to take away from this as far as aneurysms and the biplane technology.
So as far as multidisciplinary, unlike some of the stuff that I do, like I do stroke work where it's absolutely neurologists are involved. Typically with an aneurysm, it's mainly neurosurgery or anybody that does interventional and not medical neurologists. But like the patient I just saw before I met you has a large aneurysm that's not your typical aneurysm that we worry about, hemorrhage, but it's compressing his brainstem and he can't swallow. And he presented with stroke-like symptoms. So I just sent him to my vascular neurologist. So we're on the same page, and we're going to do swallow study, and then we're going to discuss him at 11:30 today at a cerebrovascular conference and come up with a next plan. I think that when doctors collaborate, patients win, right? You're getting different minds, different inputs. So there are a lot of cases that need collaboration. That's what we do. And that's really, really important. I don't think that some cases should just be decided based on one doctor. I think it's nice getting the input from other doctors with other specialties. As far as advice, I think that smoking is the worst thing that you could do with any of brain vessel-related problems, whether it's stroke or cerebral hemorrhage. There's a lot of times my patients will come and say, well, I'll tell them, we know this is really small. It's only 3 millimeters. You don't need to get this treated. But they're like, well, I have kids. I'm worried. What can I do? But they're still smoking. And I'll tell them there's really nothing to do. There's no medication that will make it go away. But there's only one thing that you could do is just to stop smoking. And unlike like lung cancer, where we have a lot of studies to show certain years of smoking and how much you smoked, we don't know with this. We don't know if 5 cigarettes a day is as bad or if it's okay as compared to like a pack a day. My biggest advice is stop smoking. And I always say I have pretty high rate of having people stop smoking. The reason is because it's not a judgmental thing. But I think that there's something about when you talk about strokes and potential things that can happen with an aneurysm rupture, I think people choose sudden death over a debilitating stroke for the rest of their lives, right? So once you talk to patients, you really tell them what it means for them to smoke. So really talk about cerebral hemorrhage and the complications that can happen with that. I think that a lot of times you can get pretty successful. I don't do any of the medications that help you stop smoking. So I work with their primary care physician. I typically just call the primary care to say, look, I'm really worried about this patient. Can we help with smoking cessation? The most important thing I want people to know is at Evergreen Health, you have doctors that are working for you. The motto here is quality service, you know, state-of-the-art technology service and doctors, but doctors that are empathetic and compassionate. Most of our visits here are like 45 minutes an hour, and our patients leave with full knowledge of what they're talking about because it's a procedure, right? They need to know why they're signing up. So it's a truly informed consent as opposed to a doctor walking and telling you, you know, if we don't do this, you're going to die. And of course, they're going to sign, but did they truly know what the procedure is about? And so that's what I would say is we're here for the community and we want the best outcomes, whether we decide to treat or not to treat, but the patient is the driver's seat for that.
Thank you so much, Dr. Abdou. As I said again, what a fascinating topic. And thank you again for sharing your expertise and coming on and explaining so very well for us what an aneurysm is and how it can be treated. Thank you again, Dr. Umun Abdou, neurosurgeon with Evergreen Health. You're listening to Checkup Chat with Evergreen Health. For more information on the latest advances in medicine, please visit evergreenhealth.com. That's evergreenhealth.com. I'm Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for tuning in today.